and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, September 15th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakros. To cross or not? Water crossing issue at Snell Crawford Park considered by FD Council. For decades, visitors to Snell Crawford Park in Fort Dodge used to be able to drive through Soldier Creek at two places to reach the far end of the site, but that hasn't been possible for 3 years. A proposed new master plan for the park on Williams Drive offers options for reopening the water crossings or permanently closing them. The City Council will ultimately have to pick one of the options. The proposed plans for Snell Crawford and Exposition Parks were introduced to the Council Monday evening during a workshop session. The Council made no decisions. It plans to discuss the proposals again on September 28th. Nathan Gruber, a landscape architect for ISG, the Des Moines firm that developed the plans, said steps can be taken to make the water crossings safer. "People like to hit the gas, splash the kids," he told the council. "We don't want them to do that. We want to bring them to a darn near stop." He said that can be done by building features that will force vehicles to slow down and separate pedestrians from the vehicles. The Fort Dodge Noon Rotary Club adopted the park in the 1980s and has spent thousands of dollars and countless hours working to improve it. Its members want to keep the water crossings, according to club member Craig Barber. "The water crossing is something the Rotary Club has really stood behind," Barber told the council. Another club member, Dr. Matt Maggio, said there has never been an accident at the water crossings. He added that it's baffling that anyone would think that crossings are a safety hazard. Councilman Jeff Halter said it seems like people want the crossings simply because they have always been there. He said if the crossings are closed, there will be no need for pavement and parking spots deep inside the park, leaving it a more natural area. The debate over the water crossings is not exactly new. The discussion has cropped up off and on over some 20 years. Advocates for the crossings say their presence allows the disabled to reach the inner portions of the park by vehicle. The crossings also enable police cars to get deep into the park to patrol, they say. Those who don't like the crossings argue that they bring vehicles too close to children playing in the water. The plan from ISG addresses more than the water crossings. It calls for creating some parking spaces close to a shelter on the Williams Drive side of the park to accommodate the elderly and disabled. It also calls for creating a patio area at the shelter that Gruber called an outdoor living room. Exposition Park on North 7th Street was once the site of Expo Pool. That pool was removed after the Rosedale Rapids Aquatic Center was built at 10th Avenue North and 32nd Street. The park is now just an open area. The plan for the site calls for sidewalks looping through the park, connecting to places where artwork would be placed. "I think it's a really neat idea," Gruber said. "It's something you don't already have." He said there would also be stations with information on the various trees and plants in the park. Late last year, the council received a petition signed by about 1,500 people asking that the park be renamed in honor of the Reverend Al Henderson. Henderson was the senior pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church and the chaplain to local law enforcement agencies and fire departments. He was killed October 2, 2019, outside his church. His accused killer, Joshua Pendleton, awaits trial on charges of first-degree murder and first-degree robbery. The park master plan presented Monday did not address the renaming request. Breaking news, Family Video announces closure. Family Video, the last video rental chain in the U.S., has announced it is closing its Fort Dodge store. The company made the announcement on Monday. District Manager Matt Rose said 25% of the inventory was sold within 8 hours of the announcement. "The store will be selling nearly everything it has in the coming weeks," Rose said. According to Rose, the impact of COVID-19 was detrimental to the business. "COVID killed the video store," Rose said. "No new releases. Hard to bring customers in with nothing new coming out, and you do that for 6 months, it's hard." "The sale will continue for at least the next few weeks," Rose said. A full story will be in tomorrow's Messenger. Murder defendant pleads not guilty. Russell charged in FD woman's January 20th death. Mark Russell, the Fort Dodge man accused of killing his ex-girlfriend's mother in January, pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder in a written arraignment Monday. Russell was charged after Angela McLeod, 45, was found dead in her North 14th Street home January 20th, following an altercation that Fort Dodge police responded to twice. The written plea was filed after Russell, 29, wrote a pro se letter directly to District Court Judge Angela Doyle, saying he would like to plead guilty in his case. "I have asked for a plea bargain and have not received it," he said. "I realize I have made a mistake and need to deal with it. I am ready to settle this right away so I can be on my way to prison." In his July 27th letter, Russell wrote that he had yet to let my attorney know and that he would disagree with this, but I am tired of sitting up here in jail. Russell was found competent to stand trial in May following his commitment to the Iowa Medical and Classification Center, Oakdale, in Coralville, where he underwent treatment after his lawyer noted ongoing concerns about symptoms related to his documented history with schizophrenia. Before he was restored to competency through treatment, defense attorney Charles Kenville told the court that Russell sent letters to him saying he wanted to plead guilty because he could better fight this case from inside the prison, in his defense. Subsequent letters said the exact opposite, Kenville said. Pro se filings in cases where a defendant is represented by counsel are not to be considered by the court, so the court will take no action, Doyle said, citing Iowa code in response to the letter. Upon Russell's arrest, criminal complaints surfaced, several incriminating statements allegedly made by him both on the scene and in subsequent interviews with law enforcement. Fort Dodge police said that during an interview with the defendant, he claimed responsibility for the injuries McLeod sustained before her death, saying that he struck McLeod at least three times with the golf club. He said that at least one of those strikes was in the face while she was on the ground. A witness to the alleged crime scene told police in a subsequent interview that Russell had verbally threatened to kill McLeod before and on the day that she died. Early Childhood Center moves forward. A local construction company has secured a sizable contract with the Fort Dodge Community School District to complete the remodel of the former Airy School and Central Administration Office Building. The FDCSD Board of Education awarded a contract for $5,964,000 to Jensen Builders Limited of Fort Dodge on Monday night. The building, located at 104 South 17th Street, will be remodeled into the district's new Early Childhood Center to house preschool, pre-kindergarten, transitional kindergarten, and kindergarten classes. The estimate for the cost of the project from Ahlers Associates Architects was $6,674,502. Ryan Utley, Director of Buildings and Grounds for the district, recommended the board accept the bid from Jensen Builders based on their past work performance and ability to finish projects by the projected substantial completion date. The district also received bids from Henkel Construction of Ames, Kingland Construction Services of Forest City, Kalachia Construction, Inc. of Fort Dodge, Pro Commercial of Huxley, Sandy Construction of Humboldt, and Woodruff Construction of Fort Dodge. Those bids ranged from $6,144,366 to $6,780,000. Construction on the Early Childhood Center is set to begin around October 1st, with a substantial completion date of June 18, 2021. This project has a lot of complexity to it, so it will be a challenge, but I'm sure Jensen is up to it, said Terry Allers, owner of Allers Associates Architects. At the start of Monday's meeting, the board held a public hearing on the Early Childhood Center project. There were no comments from the public shared during the hearing, and the district did not receive any written comments prior to the meeting. The school board approved two change orders for the new central office and maintenance facility project that is wrapping up. The first does not change the contract sum, but changes the date of substantial completion of the project from July 24th to August 21st. Second change order added $23,158.11 to the contract sum. This covers additions made after the final walkthrough of the site, like additional audio-visual boxes, additional lighting, mezzanine guardrail adjustments, and more, Utley said. The total cost of the project is now $2,952,897.24. The board accepted a quote from Lyons Painting and Remodeling of Fort Dodge for the exterior painting of the new Central Administration Building. The exterior painting was not included in the original project plan. The quote the board accepted from Lyons was for $14,045. The district also received a quote from K&D Painting of Carroll for $20,700. The painting will be completed this fall. The board also accepted a request from Fort Dodge Senior High Assistant Principal Adam Kent to purchase $13,387.26 in textbooks from the Iowa Central Bookstore to use in the concurrent enrollment classes taught at Senior High. Instructors are required to use the same edition of the textbook that is used on the Iowa Central campus. The cost is included in the district's textbook budget and covers all textbooks required by students taking classes for college credit. At the end of the meeting, Superintendent Jesse Ulrich presented his superintendent goals for the 2020-2021 school year to the board. These goals included building the capacity of staff as leaders and learners, implementing and evaluating an effective multi-tiered system of supports for behavioral and academic support of students, providing the board with level-appropriate baseline data of student achievement, continuing implementation of the FDCSD facility plan for building upgrades, and effectively implementing the Return to Learn plan and making recommendations to the board for changes that are needed. Ulrich also gave an update to the board on the number of at-home learners throughout the district. Currently, there are 908 students in the district who are using the at-home learning model, about 24% of the total district. In transitional kindergarten through fourth grade, there are 250 students learning at home, 242 in middle school, and 386 in high school. Webster County reports 57 new COVID-19 cases. Death toll jumps to 14. Webster County has gained 57 new COVID-19 cases and two more deaths in the last 5 days, according to data from Webster County Public Health and the Iowa Department of Public Health. Webster County now has a total of 14 deaths, six of which have accumulated since August 20th, according to IDPH data. The total number of cases is 1,169. Monday's report follows increases of 31, 59, and 47 cases in previous reports from WCPH. The county has gained 322 new cases in the last month since August 12th, a 38% increase in the total amount of cases. Webster County's positivity rate, the proportion of those tested whose results are positive for COVID-19, has averaged 9.3% over the last 2 weeks, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Of the cases, 808 have been in the community at large, and 74 remain open with WCPH. There have been no new cases at the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility, which has contained the novel coronavirus after an outbreak led to 361 cases and 3 inmate deaths. The cases fall into the following age categories: children ages 0 to 17, 59, adults ages 18 to 40, 562, middle-aged adults ages 41 to 60, 357, older adults ages 61 to 80, 165, elderly adults ages 81 and up, 27. Webster County public health officials continue to recommend mask use in public. With the advent of allergy season, public health officials also advise the public to know the difference in symptoms and use caution appropriately, even if unsure what to attribute symptoms to. COVID-19 and seasonal allergies are not the same thing, though they share some symptoms, including cough, sore throat, and congestion, said Kelly Bloomquist, public information officer for WCPH. However, COVID-19 symptoms also include fever and chills, muscle and body aches, new loss of taste or smell, nausea or vomiting, diarrhea, fatigue, and shortness of breath or difficulty breathing. If you aren't sure if your symptoms are COVID-19 or allergies, Please stay home until you know for sure and contact your primary care doctor to see if testing is needed. Testing is available through your primary care physician at Unity Point Health locations and at Community Health Center in Fort Dodge by appointment. Rogers Sports Complex improvements planned. FD Council awards contracts. 3 ball diamonds at Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex will be getting some upgrades. The work will be done at Diamond 3, the primary baseball field, and in the mini-major section of the complex that has 4 fields that replicate Major League Baseball stadiums. Diamond 3 will receive a new backstop behind home plate and new dugouts. In the mini-majors area, Wrigley Field and Yankee Stadium will get new backstops. The Fort Dodge City Council on Monday hired Doyle Construction of Fort Dodge to do the work at a cost of $513,945. The work will begin this month and is to be completed by mid-April 2021, according to Lori Branderhorst, the Director of Parks, Recreation, and Forestry. Woodruff Construction LLC of Fort Dodge submitted a bid of $528,007. A bid offered by Kalachia Construction of Fort Dodge was withdrawn by the company. Doyle Construction was also hired by the council to do some earth moving and to install some new curbs and gutters near the grain silo mural at Loomis Park on Hawkeye Avenue. It will be paid $46,298.70 for that work. Other bids came from Rash Construction, Inc. at $52,974 and Russ's Construction for $57,032.13. Both of those companies are from Fort Dodge. Also on Monday, the council hired Ahlers Associates Architects of Fort Dodge to design an addition to the Community Early Childhood Center at 1314 South 24th Street. The firm will be paid $127,000. The city does not own the child care center. However, in February, it received a $600,000 state grant on behalf of the center. The planned addition will provide space to accommodate 56 more children. County Auditor, only one form needed to vote absentee. Following a surge of encouragement from various non-governmental organizations to get out the vote, Webster County Auditor Doreen Pliner asked those casting their vote by absentee ballot this year in the general election to fill out just one form when requesting their ballot. The auditor's office has been receiving phone calls from people receiving multiple absentee ballot request forms, said Pliner. In addition to the official absentee ballot request form from the Iowa Secretary of State, which was mailed to registered voters after Labor Day, many other political parties and organizations trying to rally the vote have mailed out the same form. Pliner has a simple ask. Only fill out and mail back one of those forms. One and done, Pliner said. Once you have filled out one form, you do not need to fill out another form. You will receive several more requests over the next weeks from other organizations. With an unprecedented influx of absentee voting due to COVID-19 concerns, Pliner expects at least half of voters in the November election to cast their vote by mail or drop box. Absentee voters can track the status of their request form and ballot online. To confirm the auditor's office has received your request form, go to webstercountyia.gov and click on the Auditor Commissioner of Elections tab. Once there, click on Track Your Ballot and enter your name and date of birth to search. There, you can see the date your absentee ballot request form was processed by the auditor, the date the ballot is mailed by the auditor, and the date the completed ballot was received by the auditor. Ulrich gives update on district cyber attack. Nearly a week after a cyber attack shut down the phone and internet systems across the Fort Dodge Community School District, Superintendent Jesse Ulrich gave the school board an update on Monday night. On Wednesday, phone lines and internet service in all of the district's buildings went down as a result of a cyber attack on the district's servers, the district said that afternoon. The restoration of those services was slow going, forcing the district to cancel school on Thursday, but by Friday, phone and internet were restored. Our cybersecurity team is currently investigating the matter and is analyzing what happened and what we can do to prevent it in the future, Ulrich told the school board. We have not received any evidence that student or staff personal information was compromised. At this time, the district will not be communicating any more information until the investigation is concluded due to the sensitive nature of the case. A news brief. Webster County Freedom Rock dedication, Saturday. The Webster County Freedom Rock will be dedicated at 10 a.m. Saturday at 2nd Avenue South and A Street in Fort Dodge. Please bring a chair. This event is subject to CDC social distancing guidelines. The event is hosted by the Fort Dodge Veterans Council. Lifestyle brief. Babysitting Basics Clinic begins October 8th. Webster and Hamilton County Extension Services are holding a virtual babysitting clinic beginning October 8th. There will be four sessions from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on October 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th via Zoom. The clinic is open to youth in 5th through 8th grades. Registration is required by September 21st. Topics covered include child development, caring for infants and kids, basic safety skills, and parent expectations. For more details and to register, visit form.jotform, and that's JOTFORM.com/20274411394146. An editorial. Military newspaper must continue. Stars and Stripes was threatened with closure. Some in the military brass may have applauded news a few weeks ago that Stars and Stripes, the newspaper circulated worldwide to members of the U.S. Armed Forces, was being closed. Stars and Stripes, which actually began publication during the Civil War, did not hit its stride until the 20th century. Part of its popularity was because many in the ranks saw it as their newspaper, which occasionally took shots at the brass. Last month, word began spreading that Stars and Stripes would be shut down. Though the publication operates semi-independently of the Pentagon, it relies on federal funding. News of the plan to kill Stars and Stripes resulted in a storm of outrage. Even President Donald Trump, on whose doorstep some tried to lay blame for the closure, joined in. Last week, he tweeted that the paper would continue to be a wonderful source of information to our great military. Then, word came that the Defense Department had rescinded its order that Stars and Stripes be shut down. Especially annoying is the Pentagon's excuse for attempting to kill the paper. Its chosen method was to cut the $15.5 million in annual federal funding for Stars and Stripes. Economizing, you know. Many in the military and those who have served have colorful terms for such claims. We'll settle for baloney. $15.5 million is chicken feed in Washington. Saving money had nothing to do with why someone attempted to shut down Stars and Stripes. Good for the Pentagon's public relations experts for recognizing a disaster in the making. Rest assured, PR, not some general's or admiral's desire to keep serving those in the ranks, gets credit for the decision being reversed. Let us hope it never, ever resurfaces. An editorial from Diane Diamond. Prosecutors, do your job. There is a destructive crime and justice trend afoot that clearly endangers public safety. No, it is not the actions of violent protesters and riotous thugs. It is the deliberate inaction of district attorneys who are refusing to prosecute violations of law. You'd likely be fired if you failed to do what you were hired to do. It's not that easy when dealing with an elected or appointed district attorney who is tasked with investigating and prosecuting citizens who break the law. Mike Schmidt, the DA and riot scarred Portland, Oregon, announced he's dropping charges against hundreds of protesters arrested for criminal trespass, disorderly conduct, or interfering with a law enforcement officer. He won't prosecute those arrested for rioting either, unless there's some serious additional crime, such as arson, included. In July, Antifa and Black Lives Matter supporter Michael Reinel was arrested for illegally possessing a loaded firearm and resisting arrest. But the previous DA dropped the case, and Reinel was set free. In early September, Reinel confessed on videotape to fatally shooting Aaron J. Danielson, a pro-Trump supporter. Reinl said it was self-defense, but surveillance video showed him lying in wait for a target. U.S. Marshals hunted down the fugitive Reinl, and he was killed in an exchange of gunfire. Two men dead who didn't have to die. This DA dereliction of duty is occurring across the country. Progressive prosecutors are picking and choosing which laws to uphold and which to ignore. In Philadelphia, DA Larry Krasner decided to ease up on those arrested on gun-related charges. He's also against prosecuting marijuana dealers and sex workers because, he says, people's freedom makes us safer. Homicide rates in Philadelphia have risen 30% from last year, and Krasner now agrees his prosecutors should work more closely with police to crack down on gun violence. Duh. In Contra Costa County, California, DA Diana Becton instructed her prosecutors to consider looters' needs when deciding whether to file criminal charges. The head of the Antioch Police Officers Association says the policy is reckless and asks, at what point does our district attorney's office advocate for the victims, like local business owners whose shops have been destroyed? In Boston, DA Rachel Rollins has a decline to prosecute list of 15 charges, including drug possession and possession with intent to distribute, receiving stolen property, malicious destruction of property, and shoplifting. She says judges told her those crimes were bogging down the system, so she decided to ignore them. The Retailers Association of Massachusetts reports businesses there lose about $1 billion a year to shoplifting. Ignore the crime and punish the victim? Sounds crazy. In Chicago, State's Attorney Kimberly Fox campaigned on a promise not to prosecute low-level drug and shoplifting offenses and to change the way the system dealt with minority defendants. She's the attorney who dropped the false report charges against actor Jussie Smollett, who claimed a racial attack. An independent review concluded Fox dropped 5,000 cases that would have been prosecuted by her predecessor. Yes, DAs have discretion to decide which cases to take and which to drop, but this willy-nilly social experimentation with the law is dangerous. If laws are on the books, they should be upheld. If they are unfair, then state legislatures should change them. No, we don't want to be a country that locks up hungry people who shoplift food and necessities to survive. But a blanket pass for almost all shoplifters is counterproductive. Becton, Rollins, Fox, and the DAs from St. Louis and Durham, North Carolina, all female and all black, penned an opinion piece for Politico in which they openly blasted the very criminal justice system they swore to uphold. They wrote that the system was constructed to control black people and people of color and called for major changes in prosecutorial attitudes. Look, it is clear black people represent a disproportionate number of defendants in the criminal justice system. Is it because they commit more crimes, or is it because their skin color and lower income status make them more vulnerable to failures within the justice system? It could be that both are true. Let's reach an honest conclusion about the why and who of crime before making a mockery of the legal system by ignoring those laws deemed by some DAs to be irrelevant. Judge voids absentee ballot requests in Johnson County. An Iowa judge has again sided with Donald Trump's presidential campaign and voided more than 90,000 absentee ballot requests in Johnson County. It's the third county in Iowa to have the ballot request forms voided after Trump's campaign and state and national Republican Party groups challenged county election officials who mailed the forms to voters with personal information filled in to simplify the process. Judge Ian Thornhill sided with the Trump campaign in the Linn County case, and Judge Patrick Tott similarly ruled in favor of the Republicans in a Woodbury County case. Those rulings voided about 64,000 requests for absentee ballots that had been submitted. Affected voters either have to fill out a new blank form to request an absentee ballot or vote at the polls on Election Day. Thornhill filed his ruling in the Johnson County case on Saturday, again siding with the Republican groups and saying about 92,000 ballot requests sent to voters were invalid. Officials in the three counties argued they pre-filled up the forms to make it easier to vote by mail during the coronavirus pandemic. About 15,000 of the pre-filled forms had been returned by last week in Johnson County. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, September 15th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Deborah Lynn Hennings. Deborah Lynn Hennings, 56, of Fort Dodge, passed away September 11th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. A celebration of life will be at a later date. Loffersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Deborah is survived by her husband, Eric, daughters Amy Lynn, Lara Elizabeth, Sarah Janine, grandchildren Jace, Hannah, Dane, mother Janine Tarvin, brothers David Harris and spouse Anita, Bernie Harris and spouse Kathy, and Mike Harris. She is preceded in death by her father, Guy H. Tarvin. Deborah was born on March 17, 1964, in Sioux City. When she was young, she and her family moved to Fort Dodge. She graduated from FDSH in 1982, going on to earn her nursing degree from Iowa Central. She worked for many years as a registered nurse in and around the Fort Dodge area. Deborah can be described in one word: awesome. She had a true enjoyment for life. Her free spirit and sense of humor made her easily lovable and memorable to all those who had the honor to know her. She was a free spirit with an infectious smile, and she always tried to lend a helping hand, even if she didn't have much to offer. She recently found immense happiness when she married Eric Hennings on July 19, 2019. She will be missed dearly by all. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Carol Neiman. Carol Neiman, age 76, of Fonda, passed away on March 21st. We are holding a celebration of life in her honor on September 19th for family and friends of Carol. The celebration will be held at the home of Randy and Brenda Neiman from 2 to 6 p.m. Virginia Lee Norman. Virginia Lee Norman, 78, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, September 9th at Iowa Lutheran Hospital in Des Moines. Cremation rites will be accorded with Gunderson Funeral Home and cremation services. Virginia was born August 15, 1942, in Woodward, Oklahoma, to David and Marie Semmel. She was united in marriage to Kenneth Norman on June 26, 1960, in Woodward, and was blessed with two children, David and Dina. She attended Tangier and Fargo schools in Oklahoma, Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, and Iowa Central Community College in Fort Dodge. Virginia is survived by her son, David Norman, and spouse Martha of Fort Dodge, daughter Dina Borzik and spouse Joe of Longmont, Colorado, granddaughters Melissa Voltz and spouse Isaac, Jenna O'Weiss and spouse Yazin, and Allie Martinez and spouse Carlos, her great-grandson Vic, her sisters, Norma Vanderslice and spouse Ronnie of Woodward, Oklahoma, and Barbara Milton of Fargo, Oklahoma, and other family members. She was preceded in death by her husband of 52 years, Kenneth, who died in August 2012. Her parents, her sister, Carolyn Yock, and brother-in-law, Elmer, and her brother-in-law, Dale Milton. Mike Collins. Mike Collins, 79, passed away Monday, September 14th at Acura Healthcare of Pomeroy in Pomeroy. Services are pending at the Palmer and Swank Funeral Home in Rockwell City. Senior Might. St. Edmund sweeps on an evening of celebration. Sports around the state have been limited due to the novel coronavirus. The St. Edmund volleyball team nearly found that out firsthand here Monday night after the scheduled officials for their match with Eagle Grove had to cancel because of COVID-19 concerns. However, a pair of late-minute replacements were found, and the Gaels went on to honor their seniors with a sweep of the Eagles. Scores were 25-10, 25-21, and 25-11. Prior to the start of the night, St. Edmund, who are 3-1 overall, recognized seniors Sydney Engels, Casey Krutoff, and Leah Neverman. The trio shined bright on the court, recording a combined 21 kills and 6 total blocks. It's been so hard dealing with everything involving COVID this year, and it was so tough hearing that our officials could not make it, SEHS head coach Dee Huss said. Thankfully, we had a couple of local officials that were able to come over and do our match. I am just so grateful that it worked out. We were able to honor our seniors and get a win. Krudoff and Neverman each had 8 kills, with Engels adding 5. Neverman had 3 blocks, Krudoff 2, and Engels 1. Gael volleyball has made a huge impact on my life that I didn't know could ever happen, Krudoff said. It has brought me closer to people that I didn't expect to even meet, and it has also just developed me as a person. I have so much fun playing with everyone on the team, and it has really just pushed me to develop a love for the sport. Aaliyah Anderson, a junior, added 4 kills. Classmate Kirsten Clark had 5 aces and 24 assists, and Maya McLean contributed 7 digs. We had a week off, and we really used that to work on the little things, Huss said. We put some plays in, and I thought in that first set we really played well. We had some mistakes in the second, but we were able to regroup and close it out in the third. For the Eagles, who are 0-12, sophomore Alexa Jeske recorded 6 kills, and classmate Brandon Steele added 3 with a block. St. Edmund has won each of the past 15 meetings between the two former North Central Conference rivals, including 7 consecutive sweeps. Eagle Grove has now lost 50 consecutive matches. Krudoff now has 115 career kills and 123 blocks over the past 3 seasons. Neverman has recorded 107 kills, 92 blocks, and 8 aces, and Engels has 101 career kills and 68 blocks. I love my fellow seniors so much, and I wouldn't want to play with anyone else my senior year, Krudoff said. They are both so talented, and they have made this season so much fun. After making it through the softball season this past summer, Krudoff was hopeful that fall sports would be able to be played. I am so glad we get to have this year, she said. Softball raised my hopes for volleyball, but it was still very exciting when we found out we would get to play. St. Edmund returns to league action on Thursday when they host Webster City. Eagle Grove is also back competing that night at home versus Clarion Goldfield Dows. The Gaels won the junior varsity match 21-14 and 21-8. Eagle Grove claimed the freshman contest 21-14 and 21-19. Bembridge breaks through. Gaels sweep team titles in Emmitsburg. After missing out on a chance to compete this past weekend, St. Edmund cross-country team took full advantage of their opportunity in Emmitsburg Monday night. Audrey Bembridge won her first individual race as the Gaels swept both team titles at the Emmitsburg Invitational. Bembridge finished in 22 minutes, 22 seconds, sprinting past Sibley Ockenden's Bria Wasmund, who finished in 22 minutes, 53 seconds. St. Edmund scored 41 team points to place ahead of the host Ehawks as Michaela Lighting was 5th, Hannah Landwehr 7th, and Reese Lemberg 13th. It was definitely a great day to race, Bembridge said. The weather was awesome and the course was pretty much flat, which makes a race 10 times better. Getting my first win was super awesome and definitely motivating for the rest of the season, but I have to give credit to my teammates. Bembridge, a senior who has helped the Gaels reach the state meet, admitted she wasn't being the most positive person prior to the start of the race. J.C. Ash and Sydney Schulte gave me some encouraging words to boost me up, she said. This team is what makes it so much fun, whether it's a win or not. Ash would go on to win the junior varsity event, with Schulte placing 2nd as St. Edmund filled the top 5 with Andy Barwin 3rd, Addie Schulte 4th, and Ellie Berry 5th. Gracie Harvey finished 15th overall, Kelly Kirsten was 16th, and Carolyn Shelley 18th for the final SEHS varsity runners. Aubrey ran a fantastic race, Gael head coach Mike Zollett said. She passed the runner-up around the 2-mile mark and just ran a really smart race. Our girls' team is so deep, and I thought that showed. We stuck to our plan and had a great day. St. Edmund finished atop the boys' team standings with 39 points as Garner Hayfield Ventura was 2nd. Aaron Lurson placed 3rd overall, Ronnie Orris was 6th, Devin Wirtz 7th, Grant Heldorfer 11th, and Hayden Mayer 12th. Drew Zollett was 18th and Joe Lee 22nd, rounding out the varsity lineup. Just like the girls, the boys ran a smart race and stuck to what we asked of them, Zollett said. We had a really tough week of practice last week, but I thought they all did a wonderful job. Zach Lertz claimed the junior varsity race for the Gales, with Sam Miracle finishing second, Braden Smith third, and Thomas Cosgrove fifth. St. Edmund returns to action next Monday at Humboldt. Orr sets school record. Humboldt Senior beats top-ranked Muller. By the time he is finished, Quinton Orr will go down as one of the best distance runners in Humboldt's storied history. Orr added to his already impressive resume in Huxley Monday night, securing another first-place finish by capturing the 40th Ballard Invitational. The Wildcats senior crossed home in a new school record time of 15 minutes 42.3 seconds, sprinting past ADM's Nate Muller down the stretch. The mark broke his previous best of 15 minutes 52 seconds, which he set at state a year ago. Being able to go run school records is super awesome, but there is so many people that have helped me achieve these accolades, and I'm just ecstatic to hopefully finish the season out strong, Orr said. I felt great, and I went into the race telling myself I wasn't going to lose. Humboldt placed fifth overall in the team standings, which were won by Dallas Center Grimes. North Polk was second, Carlisle third, and Webster City placed seventh overall. Orr has finished second at the state cross-country meet each of the past two seasons. He will likely be contending with Muller again later this year on the big stage at Lakeside Golf Course in Fort Dodge. Muller is ranked first in 3A with Orr right behind him. I knew I was in great shape and wanted to run really fast, Orr said. We got out really fast with a sub-5-minute first mile. I just kept fighting and trying to put the pressure on the other runners. By mile two, we were at 9:55, and by then it was just Nate and me. The last mile, I just told myself it's now or never. I needed to keep pushing and being aggressive. I finally started to get away from Muller with 1,200 to go, and I knew I just had to hang on. Orr extended his appreciation to my teammates, coaching staff, and support system for helping me go out and run each and every day. Matt Lindemann had the record before I did. His dad was the coach before Coach Dean Clausen, and Mr. Lindemann substitute teaches for the school. He is such a great guy and has really given me some good advice and confidence as well. Eric Whitrock was seventh overall for Humboldt in 17 minutes 23 seconds, with Trevor Jacobson placing 19th, Nolan Juergens 28th, and Carter Thiesfeld 43rd. For the Lynx, Jacob Wilson finished 22nd in 18 minutes 31 seconds, Matthew Perrin was 32nd, Jose Ramirez 35th, and Cole Reiling 36th. Ballard captured the girls' title with Dallas Center Grimes 2nd and North Polk 3rd. Humboldt finished 10th and Webster City 11th. Ainsley Erzin of Carlisle was the race winner in 18 minutes 28 seconds. Callie Beeman was the top finisher for the Wildcats, placing 45th overall with 23 minutes and 35 seconds. Jocelyn Orr was 47th and Allison Hogue 52nd. Kaylin Butts placed 55th to lead the Lynx in 23 minutes 57 seconds, with Emma Peck 63rd. Des Moines teen dies in shooting that police say was self-defense. A man who shot and killed one teenager and injured another in Des Moines on Monday will not be charged after authorities determined he was acting in self-defense, police announced. Police said two 16-year-old males who both had handguns tried to rob a group of people in North Des Moines. An adult man in the group drew his gun and fired several times, hitting the teenagers, police said. The man had a concealed carry permit for his gun. Liam Dang of Des Moines died in the shooting. The other teenager remains hospitalized but is expected to survive. After an investigation and consultation with the Polk County Attorney's Office, the shooting was ruled justified self-defense and no charges will be filed, police said. The robbery investigation is continuing. Cause of Iowa man's suspicious death ruled undetermined. Iowa authorities have revised the cause of death of a Northwest Iowa man to undetermined after initially investigating the case as a homicide, the Iowa Department of Public Safety reported Monday. David Davenport, 66, died October 25th of severe head trauma after tenants found him injured inside a rental home on his property near Sergeant Bluff. Authorities learned of his death 2 days later when a fire damaged Davenport's home on the property. A preliminary autopsy conducted at the time ruled Davenport's death a homicide. The Iowa State Fire Marshal's office later ruled the fire at Davenport's home was accidental. Earlier this month, after investigators reviewed all case findings, the Iowa State Medical Examiner revised Davenport's cause of death to undetermined. Officials, 500,000 counterfeit N95 masks seized in Chicago. About 500,000 counterfeit N95 respirator masks have been seized in Chicago by Customs and Border Protection officers, federal officials announced Monday. The shipment of masks from China was seized September 10th at O'Hare International Airport, according to the federal agency. It said the masks were headed to a company in Manalapan, New Jersey. The masks are used to prevent the spread of the COVID-19 virus. 30 were sent to a testing facility where it was determined that 10% of the respirators tested had a filtered efficiency rating below 95%. These masks did not meet the safety standards outlined by the CDC, which puts the public at risk, jeopardizing the health and well-being of everyone, said Shane Campbell, port director for the Chicago area. Frontline workers, hospital officials, and even the Food and Drug Administration say there is a shortage of masks in the U.S. due to pressure on the medical supply chain. Dismay as huge chunk of Greenland's ice cap breaks off. An enormous chunk of Greenland's ice cap has broken off in the far northeastern Arctic, a development that scientists say is evidence of rapid climate change. The glacier section that broke off is 42.3 square miles. It came off of the fjord called Njokulhavarfjordin, which is roughly 50 miles long and 12 miles wide, the National Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland said Monday. The glacier is at the end of the northeast Greenland ice stream, where it flows off the land and into the ocean. Annual end-of-melt season changes for the Arctic's largest ice shelf in northeast Greenland are measured by optical satellite imagery, the survey known as GEUS said. It shows that the area's ice losses for the past 2 years each exceeded 19 square miles. The ice shelf has lost 62 square miles, an area nearly twice that of Manhattan in New York since 1999. Branstad steps down as U.S. ambassador to China, ends three-year tenure. The U.S. ambassador to China will step down early next month, ending a three-year tenure marked by a trade war and increasingly bitter relations between the world's two largest economies. Terry Branstad, appointed by President Donald Trump in 2017, confirmed his decision in a phone call with Trump last week, the U.S. embassy said in a statement Monday. It did not give a reason for his departure. I am proudest of our work in getting the Phase 1 trade deal and delivering tangible results for our communities back home, he was quoted as saying at an embassy staff meeting on Monday. Word of his departure leaked out earlier in the day when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo thanked Branstad on Twitter for his service. Ambassador Branstad has contributed to rebalancing U.S.-China relations so that it is results-oriented, reciprocal, and fair, Pompeo wrote in a follow-up tweet. China's foreign ministry said before the embassy announcement that it was aware of Pompeo's tweet but had not received any notification that Branstad was leaving. Branstad became embroiled in a recent controversy when China's official People's Daily newspaper rejected an opinion column that he had written. Pompeo tweeted last week that China's ruling Communist Party refused to run Branstad's op-ed, while the Chinese ambassador to the United States is free to publish in any U.S. media outlet. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijing responded that Branstad's article was full of loopholes, seriously inconsistent with facts, and wantonly attacks and smears China. The U.S. embassy had contacted the People's Daily on August 26th about the piece, asking that it be printed in full without any edits before September 4th, the People's Daily said in a statement posted online. Branstad, 73, is a native of Iowa and was governor of the major farming state for 22 years over two spans, from 1983 to 1999 and 2011 to 2017. Early in his first term, he met Xi Jinping, now China's leader, when the then county-level Communist Party official visited Iowa on a 1985 trade trip. Trump appointed him ambassador after a vacancy of several months, during which the embassy's number two official, David Rank, resigned after criticizing the Trump administration's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. Soon after arriving in Beijing in June 2017, Branstad welcomed American beef back to the Chinese market after a 14-year ban, saying, "I know it is a key priority of the president to reduce the trade deficit, and this is one of the ways we can do it." But trade relations quickly soured as the U.S. imposed tariffs on Chinese products and China retaliated in kind. Other disputes followed over technology, human rights, and the response to the coronavirus pandemic. Branstad joined U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin at trade talks with Chinese counterparts in Beijing in May 2019. The Phase 1 deal reached the following January represented a truce but did not address the more fundamental complaints of the American side. The U.S. Embassy statement also noted Branstad's role in the effort to reduce the flow of fentanyl from China to the United States, including a 2018 pact in which China agreed to list the opioid as a controlled substance. Branstad also made a rare visit to Tibet in May 2019, where he expressed concerns about what the U.S. called Chinese government interference in the freedom of Tibetan Buddhists to organize and practice their religion. South Dakota Agency. AG reported hitting deer, but hit man. South Dakota Attorney General Jason Ravensburg reported hitting a deer with his car on Saturday night, but actually killed a pedestrian whose body was not found until the next day, state investigators said Monday. Ravensburg's office has said he immediately called 911 after the crash on a rural stretch of U.S. Highway 14 and did not realize he had hit a man until his body was found. The Department of Public Safety issued a statement Monday that said only that Ravensburg told the Hyde County Sheriff's Office that he had hit a deer. Tony Mangan, a spokesman for the department, would not confirm whether Ravensburg called 911, saying it is part of the ongoing investigation. The pedestrian, who was identified as 55-year-old Joseph Bever, was not found until Sunday morning, according to the department. He had crashed his truck in that area earlier, according to relatives, and was apparently walking near the road toward it. Republican Governor Kristi Noem had revealed Sunday that Ravensburg was involved in a fatal crash and tasked the Department of Public Safety with investigating, but neither she nor the agency had provided any details. The North Dakota Bureau of Criminal Investigation is also participating in the investigation. The South Dakota Division of Criminal Investigation, which would normally be involved, is part of the Attorney General's office. It is standard practice to request an outside agency to conduct an investigation where there may be a conflict of interest. Ravensburg issued a statement Sunday saying he was shocked and filled with sorrow, but also had not provided details. His office said Monday that he had not been drinking before the crash. Ravensburg was driving from a Republican fundraiser in Redfield to his home 110 miles away in Pierre, spokesman Tim Borman said. Ravensburg was uninjured. It took investigators nearly 22 hours to identify Bever's body with a family member, leaving relatives frustrated and suspicious, cousin Victor Nemec said. Bever had crashed his truck into a hay bale near the road earlier Saturday evening, according to Nemec. Bever told his cousin that he had been reaching for some tobacco. Nemec had given Bever a ride home, which was about 1.5 miles away, and made plans to make repairs on Sunday. He left Bever after 9 p.m. The crash that killed him happened around 10:30 p.m. Nemec said there was no indication whatsoever that his cousin had been drinking. Bever lived alone and had been separated from his wife, Nick Nemec, another cousin, said. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, September 15th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.